coming. Like I said, it's just always so fun to do these in real life events and a space that is kind of meant to live online. Like when we get back together in person and see each other, is just so affirming about the space and about just really the good people that are in this space. So it's always awesome. I'm Sam. I'm the director of research at Proof. I do a lot of, I have a daily show that I publish every day with information about the space. But then I've also, Kevin Rose has been really generous. And, you know, a lot of his podcasts, he's given me the chance to interview artists and people in the space, which I always do from my computer. So it's really fun to get to do this all in real life. We wanted to, for this event, we wanted to celebrate Austin. I think one of the things that Proof does well is goes to different cities around the world, celebrates those local places. And here we have three different people from the NFT community who all live within like 15 minutes of where we're doing this event right now. And they're people from totally different sides. So we got Austin here, who's from Doodles, from one of the biggest projects in the space. We have Ipsketch, Jeff, who's a generative artist, who's had ArtBlocks curated pieces. And we got Fonz, who's in kind of the product building space. So we're gonna spend about 20 minutes talking to each of them. And I'm gonna look at my phone a little bit just because that's keeps me on time and reminds me of my questions and stuff like that.
I thought you were celebrating me. You're like, we're celebrating Austin today. I was like, oh, that's very thoughtful.
I wasn't gonna do an Austin from Austin.
Had to happen
joke,
at least
but,
once.
Yeah, Austin once tweeted how he doesn't like Austin from Austin jokes. So I stayed away, but
you gotta front run it before they get the chance.
Fair enough. Anyways, Austin, why don't you so Austin's from Doodles. I think the question everyone wants to know is, what is Pharrell doing at Doodles? We all hear about Pharrell. What's he actually doing there?
Pharrell is doing a lot. So Pharrell, hello, by the way, I'm Austin. I lead business development here at Doodles. And yeah, Pharrell is like very deeply tied to the team across a multitude of work streams. I can tell you, from his ability to get us in the door with certain companies and brand partnerships to what he's been able to unlock on the music side. There's a lot coming. Obviously, I can't give too much alpha, but he's deeply tied into the team.
Cool. So what was your, you went from being in the content game, kind of video making, interviews and stuff like that, into working in at a role at Doodles. What drove that move and when did it happen?
Yeah, so Doodles is kind of like my Web3 home. It was the second project I ever bought into. I bought a Pickle the week of Mint and was known as Pickle in the Doodles community for probably like 3 months. Fortunately grew out of that name, so you can just call me Austin now. But yeah, for me, I was working at Venice Music at the time. I've been in entertainment for 8 years, mostly on like the BD and product side, always thinking about the intersection of entertainment and technology. And the opportunity came, I had left Venice Music, the company I was at, in the summer, was building content, as Sam is well aware of, and doing some advisory work. And Julian, the CEO of Doodles, had reached out to see if I was interested in jumping on board. And for a brand that has meant so much to me in my Web3 career, and also just so much that I want to see out of the brand, being a community member who like feels the ups and downs of the community, it felt like I could really make an impact. And knowing all of the guys personally and knowing what they're about and what their goals are, it just felt like a perfect fit.
And what's that been like going from being on the outside of the world of people who have vested interest in NFTs to being on the inside on the team and seeing what it's like to be responding to that as well as building? Like, what's that transition been like?
Certainly increases your level of empathy. Like, I thought I had a decent amount before, but you realize that like these people, even if they're not online all the time and tweeting, are working nonstop. Like it is from when you wake up to like when you go to bed, like we really are focused on delivering value for our holders and building a brand, worth celebrating that our holders can be proud of. And it's been a very rewarding experience to, wake up every day and work on something you truly love, and other people can share in the joy of that. The socials can be challenging, and I thought I had pretty thick skin, but it's always a learning experience to be able to take the good and the bad when it comes to feedback and take it on the chin. So yeah, it's been fun.
I mean, we talked before you joined.
Yeah.
Because at that point it was already a very confrontational environment from the outside in. Has it been different than you expected?
Yeah. I think the community has really I've always seen my hire as a win for the community. Like I was there from day one. Like I still maintain a lot of my closest relationships are from the Doodles community. I've tried to make an effort to like really be involved in all of the group chats and see what's going on. And you have to, you know, balance that with the focus that it takes to build long-term. But I do think that it has shifted some of the perception that the team, you know, is listening, is focused, and, you know, the value, we do value the feedback, just being in those rooms and letting people know that they're heard and their feedback is very much appreciated.
Yeah. I think being on the inside of Proof, one thing, you see all the feedback that the community gives, and a lot of it is very valid, but there is never, I never think it's right when people think people don't care.
Right.
You know, internally, I will say the teams like are deeply focused on what they're doing. And that's the wrong piece of feedback. There is good feedback, but that these guys don't care or have checked out.
Right.
Like, that's like never the right interpretation, I think.
Yeah. And this is something like Frank DeGods has talked about as well, where I think wherever your perspective is, inside, outside, just being cognizant of the fact that you don't have all the information. And there are certain things that we can share, but also know that there are a lot of things that we do need to keep close to the vest and that we, you know, we will share when we're able to, but that the team is like actively, you know, working to build one of the biggest brands in the world. Like that's our goal.
Yeah. One of the kind of narrative shifts I think that's happening in NFT projects, particularly PFP projects, is a year ago you made your holders money by doing an airdrop, you know, so obviously, you know, Bored Apes has had a ton of success and Moonbirds gave people oddities and you guys gave people duplicators and, World of Women gave out Galaxy. Like that, and I think there was kind of a shift about midway through last year where people were like, wait a second, this actually isn't helping our numbers anymore. Like it's the same amount of ETH just going to more different tokens. The anticipation ends up leaving. And I feel like this year has been about projects defining who they are.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen it with Moonbirds, with Moonbirds and kind of the recent talk that Kevin and Justin gave, but how do you think, what's going to make a doodle valuable in 3 years?
Yeah, so we kind of think about how we're expanding the ecosystem more broadly, like the Web3 space. Right now, if you know, you're interacting with NFTs, you're one of a couple hundred thousand wallets that are doing that. And I think we all agree that the space needs to grow in a pretty meaningful way in order for these brands to be successful. So as we think about it, we look at our consumer journey as a funnel. And I think most projects have started at the bottom of that funnel. If you think about ownership and what it means to own one of these highly coveted NFTs that, quite frankly, only a few people can really enjoy, that's really like the crux of it. And so you move up the funnel to be able to have more people experience the brand. So we think about ownership at the bottom, and at the top, we have this like passive exposure, if you will. So that's stuff that we can do through socials. It's original content. It's showing up in places that people are going to be able to interact with the brand. And then further down that consumer journey is more of like the active interaction, the collecting ecosystem, where it doesn't need to be that you own, you know, a multiple ETH NFT, but maybe you're collecting wearables, you're expressing your digital identity, you have a companion that goes with you where you go, and it's something that you can use in your day-to-day life. And so that's kind of where we've started to move in terms of like building out this Doodles 2 ecosystem, which we can talk about, and how we really see like digital identity and expression only becoming more present and building into that wave that we believe is coming.
It does feel like there are kind of two different voices in the PFP space. On the one hand, you have Doodles, which it feels like is trying to make everybody have exposure to the Doodles brand and be the next Disney, a term I hate because it's so overused and no one's even close to being the next Disney,
no.
But maybe that's where we want to go. Like, and you get all that exposure and value accrues up. And then you have guys like Frank DeGods who are like, the way we build value is by making life as good as possible for the specific holders. And then they will become our biggest advocates and that's how we grow. Do you think that those perspectives are at opposite sides, or do you think you're actually closer to the middle than that gives you?
I don't think they're diametrically opposed. I think what you're developing is value at different layers. And so it goes back to this consumer journey. Like not everyone will live at the bottom of the funnel. And ultimately the value proposition for someone that owns one of these coveted NFTs is going to look very different than someone that just wants to experience the brand on a day-to-day basis, enjoy the original content, buy merchandise, whatever the case may be. And so it is about just understanding who your holders and your community look like at those different values. So I don't think that they're
opposed. I think we just look at the entire journey, and we want to super serve each part of it. Obviously, that's a tremendous amount of investment, and it requires a lot of people to come on board. But no, I see, you know, what Frank and those that think like him are thinking. I think we feel that we can both do that and introduce the brand in a meaningful way to a mainstream audience.
It did feel like before you got there that there was a little bit of a sort of a confrontational approach that sometimes got perceived on Twitter between the team and the holders. And it does feel like you've come in and at least made the public facing side of Doodles like really actively appreciate the community. I mean, has that been a goal of yours? Is that like part of what you think you're there to do?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly hasn't been intentional. I don't think anyone on the team, you know, got up in the morning and they're like, I'm going to be confrontational with, you know, with holders. It's just, it's a challenging thing where it's something that is your baby that you've developed into, you know, one of the bigger brands in the space. And you know how much effort and time you're putting into it on a daily basis. It can definitely like check the ego a bit. And you know, I think one thing the team has been very open about is like, historically, we've been terrible at marketing. Like we're just bad at communicating. We were, and we're actively making strides. We brought in incredible people. Bianca, who leads our head of brand marketing, I feel like her impact has already been felt in terms of how we're coming to the table, how we're, you know, interacting with the community, making sure that they're hearing from us more often. And so that, you know, we can have a healthy relationship. So I think part of it was just, you know, the team was taking on a lot. And we've grown substantially. We've like tripled the size of the team since I've joined. Wow. So yeah, it's a lot of change, I think, for the better. And hopefully, you know, holders are seeing that benefit.
Cool. Talk a little bit about Doodles 2 and about wearables. You just had the big wearables launch. Like, why don't you walk through a little bit what happened there and, you know, maybe a little bit about what you thought were the big successes and kind of the learnings from it.
Yeah, so for those who aren't familiar, Doodles 2 is like our introduction to these digital avatars that will go with you wherever you go, you know, be omnipresent, both physically and digitally. And we started by, the product's not out yet, but we started by seeding the ecosystem from OG Doodles to use duplicators to create wearables. So product isn't out yet, but we do have wearables with a market that people can buy, you know, sell it and trade. And with the goal being that we will launch into a private beta in the not so distant future, people will actually be able to dress their avatars and be able to show them, you know, on socials and things like that. What I think we did well was one of the first data bridges that I know our team is familiar with from ETH to Flow, and having a, you know, seamless experience from using your duplicator, signing in with your ETH wallet, generating a Dapper wallet on the fly, and being able to then have Flow NFTs. I think that's something that the team is really proud of. One of the areas I think we continue to work through is the communication of what product had launched. I think a lot of holders in particular saw the wearables launch as the Doodles 2 launch, which it actually wasn't. We were just seeding the ecosystem and almost giving them like a sneak peek into the various steps it takes to build a product, knowing that like private beta hasn't even launched yet. So I think that was a communication miss on our part and something we're continuing to think through, like how we develop that in the future.
And what have been some of the most exciting sales, some of the biggest sales of wearables?
Yeah, for sure. So there's been Hype Moon. I don't know if people are familiar. It's like Hype Beast, like Web3 focused, like IG channel. They had posted the resale values of like a bunch of Grail sneakers. So like the Wotherspoon 97s, like Travis Scott's, like a bunch of big mainstream shoes that people had seen. And then there were a pair of rainbow loafers that were selling for more than all of them. And that's something like, for me, I'm a huge sneakerhead, if you guys couldn't pick that out yet. Like grew up on Jordan. To see, you know, Burnt Toast art next to all of those was a personal, you know, moment of pride for me. And yeah, I think people are like really digging and the coveted wearables, the like very rare ones that come with the rare traits. I've been seeing like the coffee head sales, which I still need to duplicate my coffee, so I have a few of those. And then like the flaming jacket have all been like really cool to see.
Yeah, I'm always of the view that you should never make your NFT like have less potential options. So, the minute you duplicate it, you remove the mystery of what are you going to get. So, I do own one doodle, for disclosure, but I have not duplicated it either. But yeah, it is always like
I think we're used to almost paying like six ETH for a JPEG, but then when you see just like two color socks for $50,
yeah,
it hits you a little bit different.
Yeah, totally.
Like when you actually see those US dollar numbers, but it's cool to see that it's kind of still held up. So what is what's coming next? You say this isn't Doodles 2. What is Doodles 2?
Yeah, so we just released our Doodle map, which is our look into the Doodle universe, and it kind of gives a perspective of where Doodles 2 sits within our broader ecosystem. We've previously discussed that Doodles Records, which is going to be executive produced by Pharrell, is coming up. We'll be excited to hopefully share more about that soon. And then, yeah, we're going to be moving into private beta in the not too distant future. So this will be for holders and people that have beta passes to go use our character builder, be able to dress up their avatar and start to build out, you know, what this hub for a doodle looks like. So it's just not something that's on, you know, your PFP on Twitter, but something that can be more extensible in your day-to-day life.
Sweet. And a couple last questions before we get to the next guest. But yeah. How have your views of overall NFT space and the PFP space changed since joining the company?
Oh, man. You know, I think like I understand the inherent value even more now than I think I did then. So in my role in business development, I'm getting in front of a lot of like traditional brands that are looking to enter the space in an authentic way. And you know, we all have seen the horror stories of big brands coming in and quite frankly, like not doing as well as they should because they don't understand the market dynamics. They don't understand, you know, they see it as like a consumer product and not an actual like new way of operating with their consumer, different behaviors and ownership. And so I see a lot of potential there and a lot of continued interest. You would think like in the bear market, these brands would just go away. But if anything, it's giving them more leeway to go and experiment. So I truly believe that like the mainstream adoption is coming just by the conversations that I'm having, which is just making me even more bullish.
That's awesome. Yeah. I was doing my show on Friday and we were focusing on Starbucks because they've kind of had this success. And then I realized GQ also had a launch that didn't even mint out and it traded immediately down. But it is wild how so many corporates still are coming in, you know, despite all negative press that may be out there.
Yeah.
What do you think is... If you were advising someone, what are the tips for what to do and what not to do if you're a corporate entering Web3, launching an NFT?
Yeah, probably number one would be to not think of it as like a consumer product, like another vertical, like business line for you to just make, increase your bottom line and revenue. We've seen that happen far too often in the space. People like then come out with, they have like lofty revenue goals or focused on the short term instead of what does it look like to increase the lifetime value of your customers and improve the relationship and really the loyalty of these partners. So I would say like the do's is, you know, actually speaking to the community, figuring out what their wants are, how you can reward existing behaviors. So instead of making them jump through hoops to do something new for your brand, what are things that are already valuable that you can now reward through NFTs that you couldn't, you know, otherwise. Those would be the places I would start.
Yeah. And then last question for you.
Yeah.
What is it about NFTs and about spending money on JPEGs that makes you want to devote your career to this industry?
Yeah. I mean, so I came from music and it pretty instantly clicked for me on a couple different levels. One, coming from a licensing background, I was actually on the team that launched Amazon Music Unlimited. And I spent weeks going through the Library of Congress trying to figure out who was licensed to what, who we had to pay for what, and there are statutory damages if we don't pay the right people. So that instantly was like, oh, okay, a decentralized ledger where like I'm not spending weeks of my time. Like that's a clear value use case right there. And then, you know, more to that world, seeing all the independent musicians that weren't able to cut through the noise of streaming or they didn't have the funds to go on tour, but could now make a career for themselves, you know, through building a really deep community and the promise of, you know, not even 1,000 true fans, but 100 true fans. It's something that like I've always just been focused on like ownership and independence. And I really feel that this is an opportunity for people to see more value in the brands that they're helping to grow. It's a mission that, you know, I want to continue to build on.
Sweet. Awesome. Austin, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So glad to have you here. And now, Austin's been a good friend of mine, so it's really great to get to bring him up here, you know, in his hometown. He said he came from 10 minutes away, so that's awesome. All right, Fonz, let's welcome Fonz up from Token Proof.
GM,
the thunder of the microphone. Oh, is that an airplane?
That is an airplane.
Man, I'm losing it here.
We're close to the airport.
All right, Fonz, why don't we just ask you the same question I ended with him, kind of like one of those games. What is it about people spending money on JPEGs that makes you want to devote your career to this business?
It's been a wild journey for me. And just, I think there's a lot more behind spending money on the JPEG. And I think there's a reason why everybody's here today. And it's because we like to hang out in the flesh, right? Mm. And so being able to, have this shared experience, because everybody here owns a JPEG, and that's what links us together, and we're making interesting connections by meeting in the real life. I think that's what makes me, want to devote my career to something like this.
Yeah, that's cool. It's like almost like the online thing brings us together in the real world. And I would say most people here own JPEGs, but some know someone very well who owns JPEGs.
Exactly.
But we're all in that camp, either own them or have seen someone's life get taken over by JPEGs. But let's talk about you here and your company. Why don't you give a little bit of background on Token Proof and kind of, yeah.
Yeah, so Token Proof has an interesting journey. So I'm a refugee of the oil and gas industry. I've been in Texas for about 21 years, and I spent most of that time in Houston. And I sold a startup in 2017, then worked for the company that bought my startup for 3 years. And then something called COVID happened around March 2020, and I got connected to essentially the group that built Microsoft in the 90s, and they had the idea that eventually there would be a COVID vaccine, and that eventually we would have to get that vaccine, and that we would have to prove to the world that we had that vaccine to operate, like getting into an airplane or going to a bar or going to a movie. And so they thought that we would need to trust something that was more than just pen and paper, right? And so they thought, why don't we build something that has to do with QR codes, where you show up at the door and you prove that you have the vaccine through cryptographically signed QR codes, right? And that whole deal morphed into what everybody now knows as vaccine passports. And I got tapped to be founder and CEO of that company that was one of the early players in the industry. And then we found ourselves in the middle of a lot of politics and a lot of difficulties. So we shut that business down. Then I had been working for about 20 years nonstop. So I decided to take a break from work. And I had seen Beeple back in March of 2021 sell his $69 million piece. And I started learning about NFTs, though I couldn't really devote a lot of time to it because I was doing CPR on this vaccine credentialing business. And now that we had shut it down, I was like, all right, I'm going to figure out how to set up my MetaMask and how to buy JPEGs. And I bought, a bunch of shit that is now worth zero. And some stuff that is still worth something and that I've made a lot of connections through. And then I went to NFT NYC and the first Ape Fest, and I realized that the mechanisms for me to prove that I owned an NFT were pretty much non-existent. Yuga Labs was using Google Sheets at the door. ApeFest 2021, which was ridiculous. And some of us went in that 4-hour line and we made good friendships, but still it was a 4-hour line in New York. And so eventually December of 2021, somebody tweeted, is anybody thinking about how to prove that I own an NFT with QR codes? And I was like, holy crap, we actually built this, but we built it for vaccines. So now I got to go 1,000 miles per hour and pivot this technology and make it into a Web3 NFT proof of ownership thing with QR codes. And that's how Token Proof got started. And now we've hosted over 250 real world experiences, including this one, because a lot of you joined this event or gained entry to this event by proving that you own a Collective Pass or a Moonbird or Nodity at the door. And that's what Token Proof is we're connecting Web3 with the world and making sure that you're able to unlock the utility of your tokens in the real world.
And what are the major use cases that you're seeing right now? What are the different examples of times that people use Token Proof?
Yeah, I mean, I think events is our bread and butter. And so things like what we're experiencing here is very important. Though I like to say that marketing is not about isolated touch points, but it's about orchestrated touch points. And so something that we did at ApeFest, for example, if you got your token proof scanned in at ApeFest, you immediately had access to the Shopify store for ApeFest, right? And so it's joining one experience with another and blurring that line between online and the real world, where because you attended an event in the real world or an activation, then you can go online and maybe get access to an e-commerce shop or get access to a exclusive live stream. And we're working with major brands today in making sure that they're able to make use of their Web3 tokens in the real world, where you'll be able to walk into a store tomorrow, scan a QR code or tap on an NFC tag, and then mint a token because you went to the store, you purchased something. And then it's all about creating direct relationships between the brand and the customer.
One thing that occurs to me is that you started with this big use case, this monumental use case of vaccine kind of proof of vaccine, realized actually it doesn't work for that. And not now you're doing NFTs and events, but where do you see, I feel like you're the perfect person to talk to about future NFT use cases. I think so many people in this space are focused on the idea that it's not just a PFP, it's not just art, there's a lot more this can be. What's your view on that? What do you think are the limitations and what do you think are the opportunities here?
I think the big opportunity is, like I said, for these brands to have a direct and meaningful relationship with their fans and their audience, right? Because when you talk to a brand like Nike or Adidas or NBC Universal or Warner Music, they'll tell you that the customers are guarded by the platforms right now. So basically, if Adidas wanted to have direct access to their consumer, they still, it's very hard to do that because they have to go through a Facebook or a Google. And so what we're doing enables brands to have a direct and meaningful relationship with those customers, where because I went to the Adidas store and I minted a token right there on the spot using Token Proof, then Adidas can send me personalized offers or a push notification that says, hey, you haven't been to the store in 3 weeks or 2 months or whatever. Here's a 10% off coupon that we're going to airdrop you. And that's the direct connection that a brand can have with their audience. Or we're talking to NBC Universal about putting QR codes on TV shows so that the audience is incentivized to watch the show, I don't know, Top Chef, every week. And as you watch the show, you scan a QR code and then you mint a proof of engagement token into your wallet and you're a special fan now. And they're able to reward you in different ways, right? So the way that I think about Token Proof is that we're focused on bringing the next wave of non-crypto native users into Web3 to experience what we all know and love here.
Nice. What about, one of the things that I think that worries me most about NFTs is the idea of security. And it's the fact that with Bitcoin, it's very easy to put your Bitcoin in a drawer, never look at it again. But what you're business is proof of is that NFTs are living, breathing objects that require interaction with contracts, which just opens the door for so many scammers and people to create fake links and token proof with 3 O's instead of 2 O's or whatever. How are you seeing a lot of that? How do you see us kind of getting past that? What are your general views on that?
Yeah, I mean, when we came into the space, the whole thing was, how can you prove that you own an NFT without connecting your wallet, right? And we still stick to that because it's now it's not the entire Token Proof as a company. It's a feature of everything that we do, right? And so I'm sure we'll get into it, but we announced last week that we're partnering with Coinbase so that we integrate their wallet as a service into the Token Proof app, and I can give more details around that. But I think we need more focus on security so that people stop falling into these malicious traps that, you know, a lot of us have fallen into. And you know, you connect your wallet into something you shouldn't have, and then you get your tokens drained. I think there's a better way of doing it. Web3 still has a lot of friction. It's still very cryptic. You don't really know what you're signing. You're like, all right, I hope that this is not, you know, some scammy website. And then you hit sign and then, you know, we'll see what happens. And I think there's a better way of doing it, and hopefully we'll contribute to that. And I mean, even Kevin was victim to this, right?
Yeah.
And so that gives you an example of even the experts are vulnerable, and we need to be better as a space, and hopefully we'll contribute to that as well.
Can you talk a little bit about that wallet as a service? Coinbase launched wallet as a service last week, and I had to cover it for my show, but I didn't quite understand. So I always have to like go through this rush process of figuring out what something is so I can tell people about it. But why don't you give us a bit of a better overview of what that product was?
So right now, when you download the Token Proof app, you have to come in with your own wallet that you previously set up, right? So you've set up your MetaMask, your Trust wallet, your Ledger wallet, and then you link it with the Token Proof app. If we really want to onboard the next 100 million users into Web3, I can't really tell my dad that he needs to set up his MetaMask. And by the way, be careful. You got to protect this 24-word seed phrase and lock it in a safe at a bank. And then download the Token Proof app and then link the wallet to the token. It's just too much BS and too much friction for the general consumer. And so now what we're announcing formally tomorrow with Coinbase, we teased it last week, is that we're integrating an actual wallet into the Token Proof app where my dad will be able to download the app, register with his email address, and we're going to give him his first crypto wallet. So that reduces a lot of the friction. And now my dad can walk into a store and scan a QR code and mint a token right there on the spot with zero knowledge of how the blockchain works. And so Coinbase has been a great partner because they have this product that is the wallet as a service. It's a self-custodial wallet with no seed phrases involved. And so it's using multi-party computation technology where the private key is split into different shards. And I don't need to get into the technical aspect of it, but it's highly secure while still making it user-friendly. And so we like to be seen as the experiential wallet. We're not this highly transactional wallet. We're the experiences wallet. And by embedding the Coinbase as a wallet as a service product, we're going to be able to onboard more and more people into the space.
Nice. Kind of going to a question I asked Austin, I'm curious for your perspective as well. You're working with corporates. It sounds like corporates are interested in this technology. What are you seeing as the do's and the don'ts for corporates that want to be involved? What are they saying to you as far as their hesitations for getting involved in the space versus what they're excited about?
That's a great question. I think we saw a lot of brands in 2021, even 2022, that came into the space. They saw an opportunity to monetize their IP. They sold NFTs and opened up a Discord. And then they're like, all right, now what do we do? Like, you know, we've done what we were supposed to. Now we've gained millions of dollars out of the mint. But now we have this community that is eager to participate, and they're asking, all right, what's next? What's next? What's next? And we don't know what's next. And so now I'm pushing brands away from selling a token, and I'm pushing brands to give tokens for free as their customers engage with the brand. So I think Starbucks is a great example of how they're doing it. Mm. You're not really paying for your membership into the Starbucks Odyssey program, right? The membership into the program is free. Your participation and your engagement is what gets you the stamps and future rewards. And I think that's the way that it should be. I think that a lot of brands saw an immediate opportunity to monetize, and they didn't think about the long-term consequences of that. I'm more interested in brands looking at the long game and offering things to people that are really interacting and engaging with the brand, right? So to me, that's the opportunity, is stop selling NFTs on the front end. You can still sell NFTs. Starbucks did it last week.
Yeah.
They sold 2,000 NFTs?
2,000, yeah. And they sold for $100 each. They didn't give it for free. So what's the differentiation between what you're saying, give it away for free, and do what Starbucks is doing?
Well, you can have a mix, right? But don't lead with selling a token.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Just weave it into the journey as you progress.
Yeah, I think the corporates miss two things a lot of time. The first is how important it is to have insiders in the, like, there aren't that many people who are going to buy NFTs. Like, it's just, so having people like G Money for Adidas,
yep,
really gave that project a huge lifeline, you know? And I think if you don't have those insiders, it can be very, very difficult. And the second thing is realizing how, you know, people are investing money in your product when they buy in the old school version.
and realizing that to keep those things valuable, to protect your collectors, make them have a good experience, you need to have a lot of resources devoted to this.
Yep.
This is not a one and done thing, because the last thing you want is for people to have a JPEG in their wallet and they're one of 5,000 people, and then 3 months later, no one's paying attention to it and they just lost money. You know, so I do think corporates miss that, but I guess the free route, it's very much the Gabriel Layden view. Gabriel is, I don't know if you know Gabriel, who runs Digi Daigaku and had that Super Bowl ad, but he's obsessed with this idea of free NFTs, maybe for different reasons, but
I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Last question for you, and I'm also going to ask all the guys who've been here to who are speaking to stick around. So in case people want it, we can do a little Q&A at the end if anybody in the audience does have questions. But last question for you. I'm obsessed with data. I love like just looking at charts and seeing what that tells us about the way this community is interacting. What would the data about events say? What interesting data is there in the Token Proof database that talks about how many people are trading NFTs or participating in events? You know, is the slower market versus a year ago having effect on what you're seeing? Like what kind of insight can you give us from your data?
I think what's clear to me is that there's less focus on these gatherings that are like NFT insert city name, right? Like NFT NYC, I don't really know what to expect from it next month. I think we saw a really good turnout at NFT Paris, but things like NFT LA, NFT NYC, which is conferences that, here's what I'll say. There's a lot of people that think that throwing a conference is easy and just saying, all right, NFT Austin, and this is going to be a major gathering. And it's hard to put on a conference. And so I think that we're going to see smaller events throughout the year rather than this huge, huge gatherings where everybody congregated. But I'm still super bullish on events because y'all are here today. And because making real life connections is still paramount to whatever we do in the internet, right? I mean, it's fun to hang out on and shit posting on Twitter, but nothing beats being in the flesh, interacting with one another, having a drink. And to me, I think events are going to continue to be very, very important. And I think there's going to be more events, just smaller and more focused events than these like huge gatherings that we've seen over the past couple of years.
Yeah, it is wild how in this space people can really unleash on people online. There's something about that barrier that just brings out, you know, I think normally pretty decent things in people. Most people are pretty pleasant and smart online, but then the 5% can be pretty ugly. And then you meet people in person and realize that it really is just such a great group of people.
It's great.
In the space. It's awesome. And it's awesome having you here. You know, we met in LA and it's great to have you back. So thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you so much. Cool. Thank you.
All right. And the last guest is Jeff, IPP Sketch, IP Sketch, one of the curated artists on ArtBlocks. So, and for those of you who don't know, the way that ArtBlocks works is to get onto curated, that has to go through a whole board review to make sure that the board has approved and kind of is excited about your work. So one of a limited number of artists from that group that we have here today, Jeff. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what's it like right now in the generative art community from your perspective? I feel like there's a lot of attention on Blur and on royalties going away, and it feels like generative artists and ArtBlocks artists are kind of just sitting there watching and don't have as much say in it as they deserve. What's been your experience?
Royalties, huh? You want me to start with royalties?
All right, here we go.
I mean, sure, as artists, we love royalties. I think Snowfroze, Eric Calderon, the founder of ArtBlocks, has spoken to this probably the best, and I'll probably just refer you to him. But, you know, it's hard to enforce them on chain.
Yeah.
There's always ways to circumvent it. And even if those are tried to put in place, there's going to be ways to circumvent it. So it really is a cultural kind of phenomenon. Mm. And it's more about, you know, respecting the culture around it and the artists themselves. So, I mean, I hope that they continue and just out of the respect that, you know, is out there. So, but yeah, that's tough.
Are you seeing people have less interest with this kind of, with this revenue stream and kind of, I think a lot of people were brought into NFTs hearing a podcast where someone talked about how this tech is amazing because artists can make money into perpetuity. And a lot of the promise seems to be like it's in question right now. Are you seeing less interest from the artists? Are you guys like still let's go? This is a great, something we're passionate about, a great business.
Yeah. I mean, as artists, we love to make digital art And this has been a new medium and a new, you know, way to get our art out there and for people to actually purchase it. So we remain excited.
Awesome.
In the face of, you know, royalty.
Yeah. Why don't you give a little background on yourself?
Sure.
Both as kind of like what got you into generative art and then talk a little bit about the projects you've put out there.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Jeff. My online artist name is IPP Sketch or IP Sketch. So it stands for I++ Sketch. So I'm a generative artist. I write code to make art. And I++ is a coding kind of thing you use to increment a variable, I, forward, so 0 and then 1. So it's a reference to the code behind the art. I picked it for Twitter, IPP Sketch, and then my 9-year-old son, you know, heard me say it, IPP Sketch, and I never heard it. Like, I never put it together, wow. Which was a little disturbing. So IP Sketch, I think, is what most people say in their head, which is probably better.
It is wild, like, how much our kids' heads just live in the gutter, and there's nothing we can do about it.
I mean, it's pretty obvious in retrospect, but...
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm a full-time engineer. I'm a full-time mechanical engineer, and so I work with code and computers a lot, and, you know, making art and then selling art on the blockchain has really allowed me to expand the creative side of which doesn't get to be expressed so much in engineering.
And are you a full-time generative artist, or do you have a full-time job and do this as well?
I guess I'm doing both full-time. So I'm a full-time mechanical engineer working on medical devices, and I'm also a generative artist.
Yeah, it is. When I went to college, they talked about how some people were fuzzies and some people were techies.
Yeah.
And I feel like generative artists are the ultimate unicorn because you have this really great technical side, but then also this real ability to create beautiful things and see that. Are both of those natural for you, or did one of them come first, and how did you marry that all together?
I think being kind of productive and, you know, with like real world problems, I mean, that's fun, but it's not creative. Well, I mean, sometimes it's creative, of course, and then there's also this creative side that we all have that, you know, I've always had. Like, I've enjoyed watercolors. I got into that for a while. I enjoyed drawing and things, but there was never, this way to kind of express that in the way that this has allowed me to in terms of the creativity. So it's been a real opportunity for that.
Yeah. If this weren't a live show and we were on Zoom together right now or Riverside or whatever, I would be pulling up some of your art, showing it to people. But why don't you talk a little bit about Bent? Because Bent was your curated project. It came out a year and a half ago and is just really beautiful art. But what was your goal with your first collection on ArtBlocks?
Yeah, Bent was a thing. So that it was curated in our ArtBlocks November 21. So yeah, about a year and a half ago. And it's hard to write the computer code to make a curated piece on ArtBlocks. It was a lot of work. I mean, it was probably 9 months of time I spent writing that algorithm to make that art. And it was really fun and it was really exciting and it was really stressful. It's a process to get on ArtBlocks. Like, it takes months of review and you know, there's a lot of gates to get through and it's very stressful, but it was extremely exciting for sure.
Yeah. And what were you surprised at all with how people interpreted the art and how people interacted with it and what was expensive? Did any of that surprise you, how the market interacted with it?
Yeah, the market is that's a whirlwind. It's hard not to tie your as an artist, it's hard not to tie like your self-worth to the floor price. You know, it's like whenever I think about how good of an artist I am, I go look at like the Bent floor price, and that's my value for the day. Mm. I say that a little tongue in cheek, but it's hard seeing the market dynamics around like in real time every day. Whenever I want to go check it, it's a stressful thing to be a part of for sure.
Well, regardless of what the market says, it is awesome work. And you know, I wouldn't obviously.
Yeah,
but I can see where that's very difficult.
You know, I make the art. And especially like Bent curated, it's done. Like the mints have been generated. I've done my piece and it's out there now. And so that's, you know, that's ideally what I go back to.
But what, one thing I'm always thinking about buying art blocks is that in that moment that you buy an art block, there's a ton of attention on the artist that recently gets revealed, you know, and people are saying this is the next XYZ. And then that attention fades and it moves on to something else. It moves on to AI. It moves on to doodles. It moves on to what someone said yesterday. You know, and how do, you know, in a world with, what have you observed after 18 months of seeing Bent on the market in terms of what kind of creates the price fluctuations, what adds or subtracts attention from it? Like, what's, it's such a long time and it's going to go on forever, but what have you learned through that process?
Yeah, the market, like I think I said, it's strange and it's a roller coaster. And I don't know. It is funny how much things are tied to like Discord. Even if you can get somebody to mention your project on Discord in some positive way, it can create these like strange cycles where dozens of things get picked up on secondary, and it's just a strange secondary marketplace to kind of watch and see.
It does kind of speak to how so much of the process of being an artist in this space is also in some ways doing things that keep attention on your work. And I think that for a lot of artist personalities, that can actually be really difficult. It can be more self-promotional than their personality naturally wants to be. Mm-hmm. Like, is this something you've seen, and what's been your experience?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, and I don't like that. So I like making art. That's what I enjoy. So I make the art and I put it out there and hopefully people buy it if they like it. And maybe the prices will go up if other people like it and want to buy it. And I try as hard as I can to not let the floor price, you know, define my self-worth, and to also not get caught up in all the marketing kind of cycles and games that are out there. I mean, it's my role as an artist, I see, to make the work. Mm-hmm. and to keep making work and to keep practicing my craft and to keep releasing things. And I try not to, you know, control the secondary marketplaces through any kind of hype or you know, engagement. I just try to make the work, and hopefully it speaks for itself.
One other thing that seems to have impact is how much supply you put out there. So Terrell Jones, who's here. What's up, Terrell? You know, when Terrell was on the podcast, and I encourage everyone to go listen to it because he's got such a wonderful story and is such an accomplished artist. But one of the things that he and I talked about, he said that his strategy with supply is just to get so much of his work out there that everybody owns it, everyone wants it, and more people are talking about it, more people want it. You know, and then you have other artists who are like, I want to drop one piece every quarter because then it's super limited and it becomes this real kind of rare object that makes it more prestigious. Every artist has a different strategy depending on their personality. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I like to make more art and I like to release more art and to get it out there to as many people as I can. So I mean, I'm always kind of working on a project and I'm always making more art on my computer. And when I get to a point where I like it and I think it's done, I don't try to hold on to it, you know, kind of waiting for the next cycle or maybe thinking about like, how's the most rare way I can make this of most value. I just want to get it out there to as many people as I can. So I definitely agree with that. And I like that aspect a lot. So I do have a lot of projects and I'm okay with that. And I'm on Tezos and Ethereum because I like kind of, you know, diversifying the collector base. And I'm always thinking about and releasing as many projects as I can. I think ArtGnome, I think, had a interesting article on this at one point about, I think he was looking at all these artists and how much work they had released over time. And it was Picasso and Andy Warhol who were just super prolific. They released a ton of work. Way like orders of magnitude more than their contemporaries. And they're some of the most, you know, popular names. We like, everybody knows those two. And because they release so much work, and a part of that is developing your craft. You know, it's working more and more on what you do. And part of it is, yeah, getting it into more hands, because the more hands you have, even one small, like 10 tez, $10 piece of art, they know your name. And then they might be more interested to collect in the future. So I'm all about more art.
One of the things, Jack Butcher, who did this VV Jax project, like he had checks that were selling for 10, 12 ETH. I mean, there were, if they had a low enough serial number, and there were 16,000 checks. And even after that, his one of one work was selling for like 7 ETH, you know? And I think it is about this network you create of all these people on Twitter who want your work to do well, who start promoting your work. And I think it is why we see a lot of times that like the grails or even the sets of 500 sell at higher prices. And you've seen this too, than the one of one sometimes,
yeah, that's right.
You know, even though there's a uniqueness to the one of ones.
Mm-hmm.
What, you recently launched Imposter Syndrome, right?
Yeah.
And what was the? I mean, it's a very different piece. It looks mm-hmm. very different from the previous work you put out. How was that experience different? Doing a presents project versus curated, kind of like a follow-on project.
Yeah, so curated was first on Art Blocks, and then after you're curated, you can come back in and release another project. It can be curated, but it's pretty rare to be. But yeah, Imposter Syndrome was 100 editions. It's an extremely simple work. Like, it's like you all could have done it.
We should do some lessons. Like, I want to learn.
Yeah, it's, you know, like my 5-year-old could have made that, like in kindergarten, cutting out paper. Like, it's one of those pieces. It's the canvas is split into two colors, like in halves, and then there's a shape on the border, and then that shape is casting shadow and light in each direction. So it was an extremely minimal work. I didn't show it to anybody before, which is rare for me. I've never done that before. And the work itself is meant to be about how I find myself on the border between, you know, kind of my real life. Like, I have a real name. I'm an engineer. I have a family. And then I'm also have this like online Twitter presence. I'm Ipsketch. And there are these two kind of totally separate lives in a way. And I feel like an imposter sometimes in both of them. Like, people in my real life don't know that I'm Ipsketch.
Oh, really?
And you guys don't know my real name. And so it's a strange new world I'm living in. And the piece was meant to kind of speak to that.
How did that feel, putting something so that you find so technically simple out into the world and making that your second big project?
Yeah, the technically simple part. I mean,
I'm not saying it's simple. That was your words.
That also, no, I know.
I'm just joking.
Yeah, I mean, that also. That's a good question. I was very nervous to release it because it's so simple.
But it's also so personal, which maybe adds a dimension to it.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. Last question. What would be your advice? You talk about how hard it is, how you spent 9 months working on Bent, how hard it is to go through this Art Blocks project, the curation project. Mm-hmm. What's your advice to generative artists who are watching in and who are thinking this is something they want to be involved in?
Yeah. Make more work is my biggest piece of advice. Like, there's this great book called Art and Fear that you should read. That. That's one of my pieces of advice. It's a really good book. And it talks about this ceramics classroom, where the teacher gives half of the class the assignment to make the perfect pot. Like, that's their assignment. You can, at the end of the semester, you have to turn in this one perfect piece. And the other side of the classroom, he says to just make as much pottery as you possibly can, and he's gonna judge you or grade you based on the weight of that pottery. And at the end of the semester, it's the class who makes the most by weight that has the best pieces, just because they made more. And by making more, you learn more, you make mistakes, you grow. So that's my biggest piece of advice, is to just make things and put it out there, because that's the best way to grow and learn, for sure.
I love that. That is so awesome. Not to talk about Jack again, enough people are talking about Jack, but a lot of his visualized value work is all about mm-hmm. this concept of just doing stuff mm-hmm. and how the person who's not doing stuff kind of just sits there, and the people who are doing stuff fail and succeed, but just moves higher.
Yep.
And those messages resonated with me. So it sounds like that's been a good story for you as well. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Jeff, for coming on. Sam. Appreciate it. All right, I think we're going to end the official podcast. But if anyone does have questions, I know there are only a few people around, but it looks like people want to move on. But if anyone does have any questions for the guests who are here, these will not be online questions, but you can also just feel free to go and ask them in person. We got Jeff, we got Austin, we got Fonz. Thank you guys for sitting in, and thanks a lot for these guests.
All right, that is it for this episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you would like to help us out, head on over to proof.xyz and click on the reviews button at the very top and leave us a 5-star review. Thanks so much. Take care.